I'll try to do better.
No, it's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Sam.
And I'm your co-host, Josh. And Josh, we are here again.
It's good to be with you this evening.
Sam, it is fantastic to be with you.
Sitting here in my kitchen late at night.
Yep.
Just had some Parmesan-encrusted gnocchi.
I believe...
Gnocchi?
I think it is gnocchi, actually.
Gnocchi?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Honestly.
So. Just chilling out, man. Enjoying life.
Yep. So, I heard that you went to a little release party the other day.
Oh, dude. It was so cool. So, if you guys don't know, Kingly, who's huge supporter of our podcast, lets us use their music and stuff like that, they came out with an EP this last month in January, and Kim and I got to go to the release party. It was incredibly cool. If you haven't gotten that EP, you should do it right now. It's on iTunes and Google Play and all those things. I think it's like $3.80. It's some weird number. It's not $3 or $4, but it's super cheap. Really, really excellent music. If you like our intro bumper music, it's in that same vein, kind of original worship music with kind of that produced electronic kind of almost like Hillsong Young and Free Stadium kind of vibe or whatever, but I think a little more organic feeling than that. But just really, really enjoyable. So we got to go be a part of that. They played, and then another local St. Louis worship band called Chutes and Canes played also, which, oh my goodness, Josh. Chutes and Canes. Oh my goodness. You need to Google that junk.
How do you spell those two words? Because they have multiple spellings.
I mean, it's in reference to like a grapevine, so Chots and Canes.
Chutes, okay, and canes. Okay. See, I was thinking like chutes and ladders.
Yeah,
but like with,
I was thinking eat chutes and leaves.
That's
the joke. You
pretty
know?
Good too.
Yeah,
and the book about punctuation.
Yeah, but it's dude, just so good. Really, really kind of organic indie feeling. Worship. I mean, tons of vocal harmonies. The three vocalists who lead from two violins and a piano with a band playing behind them. Like, so good. And both those bands have stuff online. But it was just really, really cool to be a part of it for a couple of reasons. I mean, it was both those bands are bands that are really passionate about the church and passionate about, I think, serving the church and creating art that is a gift to the church and to people who love Jesus and want to worship their music. And so that was cool just to kind of receive that gift from them. But then also it was really cool to me to be reminded that there actually is like a living artistic creative scene in St. Louis.
Yeah.
That there's actually some people making high quality art. And as a Christian, it's cool to me to see Christians who are making high quality art and doing it in St. Louis. I think so often in our city, people think if I'm going to be successful in creative world, I have to go somewhere else to create cool things. And these are people who've literally intentionally said, we're going to be creatives and we're going to stay in St. Louis and we're going to be part of a creative movement in St. Louis, which I think is cool.
Yeah, there's lots of creativity going on in St. Louis.
Yeah.
There's
like one, name one thing, Josh.
There's like
I'm just kidding.
I think it's called Create Space in the Delmar Loop.
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So that's a thing.
Yeah. Have you been to it, Josh? What's it like? Tell me about it.
Well, I haven't, but you know.
Can I mention our soundboard?
What is a soundboard, Sam?
I just see, Josh. You do all the intelligent, smart stuff for our podcast where you like read books from the 1800s and you do research. And I do the part where I edit it on a computer. And I got us a DJ app that lets us lets us add in like our bumper music and things like that. But it's in the form of this touch soundboard. So like that's how I put in like our intro music, but it also has all these awesome pre-built sound effects that I think we need to start incorporating into the podcast.
I mean, we can try. But you're going to have to like recognize the opportunity and like hit the button like all in the span of like a second, or else it's like,
what was that, Josh? Let's back that up. Say again.
Oh man. This is going to be, I hope, like, you know, some of our listeners are more in your sense of humor and liking that stuff.
What was that? Oh, pump the brakes, Josh. Slow down just a minute.
I'm going pretty slow already.
Oh, no. Hopefully we won't use any of those terrible sound effects. Unless, like, we could use the cash register if we're, like, pumping someone's book. Go buy Kingly's album. See, like that? That could work.
I like it. I like it.
I'll probably forget to do it, though. So.
That's the only problem.
Yeah.
You gotta.
It has four sound effects for punching.
That seems a disproportionately excessive.
Well, that one's a miss. So it's like hit, miss. Okay, I'm done.
All right. And with that, let's talk about our very serious topic of conversation.
Yeah, tonight. That was a terrible way to introduce the fact that we're actually having a pretty heavy conversation tonight. So I pre-apologize for that, everybody.
You should play the back that up thing now.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, today we're having a little bit of a serious conversation, but I think it'll be good for us. If you were with us last time, we started a conversation. I can't do it.
You're doing so well. I was going to roll with it. I was going to roll with it, or try to.
But seriously, so this is our second podcast talking about faith healing. The idea of does God supernaturally heal people who are hurting or sick? And so in part one, we kind of talked about the positive aspects of that. We talked about kind of charismatic theology and maybe the more mainline evangelical theology of healing. And we played clips of people who've had like these powerful personal stories of, man, this happened and God showed up and healed people. And we told some more famous kind of healing stories that you can connect with online, and talked about some of the arguments against that that you see maybe in a more secular setting in those things. So that's kind of how we started the discussion, is from a more positive side. And tonight we're going to talk about the other side of the coin. We're going to talk about, as a Christian, theologically, what do you do with the reality that people don't always get healed, that people suffer and die?
Yeah, because it obviously is very painful. If you are yourself experiencing a illness or a disease and not being healed, and even more or also painful to know someone who is going through something, especially if they end up passing on.
Yeah.
And that's really hard. And I wanted to talk too a little bit about some of the details of the more charismatic theology, because it's hard enough if you don't have a healing. It can be even harder in the context of if you're like really, really expecting or believing that you should be able to get this healing.
Yeah, so why don't you reintroduce the goalposts that you used from last time to kind of put some terms and framework around our discussion?
Yeah, so the one goalpost is the question of, does God heal? And we kind of talked last time about some of the reasons that people might be skeptical of healing stories, and some of the reasons that we believe that at least some of them are legitimate. And then on the other side, you have a question of, does God always heal or always want to heal, or is healing always something available we should be pursuing? And how you have kind of a lot of evangelicals kind of in the middle, believing God sometimes or could heal. And then on the other side of the goalpost, the more charismatic theology saying that healing is something that's always available or should be. And so I kind of want to briefly sketch a little bit of that. And this may not be all the best arguments for that, but just kind of if you're not as familiar with some of those ideas, especially around like commanding body parts to be healed and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So when you're talking about suffering in general, I think it where you land on this spectrum is really, really important because, I mean, to the person who doesn't believe in anything supernatural and doesn't believe in it, to the atheist, personal suffering and family suffering is a terrible thing. It's painful. It hurts everyone involved. To the Christian who believes God could have stepped in and healed but didn't, I mean, that's a different kind of pain of just kind of, it leaves you with the why, like, oh, but you could have and you didn't, and now I have to deal with that. But when you step into that more charismatic theology and you have someone who's saying, biblically, I believe it is always God's will to heal someone, and then they aren't healed, that, I mean, that messes with your very foundation of who God even is. So in the midst of also experiencing the pain, I mean, it's breaking your personal theology and your relationship with the church and with Scripture, you know?
Yeah. Well, it can. I mean, so yeah. We're going to talk about kind of some of the spectrum of responses and ideas. So some of the charismatic theology, we have this idea that Jesus spent a significant amount of his time healing people. Also in Acts, the apostles did similarly. Jesus made numerous statements about, if you ask anything in my name, it will be done.
Yeah.
He talked about giving the disciples power to do such things. Jesus talks about, if you have faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. You will do even greater things in my name. Then there's other references that are discussed, like Isaiah 53, talking about Jesus as the sacrificial lamb that says, by his stripes we are healed.
Yeah.
And I think there's also in Psalms a reference to he heals all our diseases. So there's kind of this theology of Jesus' death on the cross did not only provide salvation for sin, but also provided authority over sickness, and that this was demonstrated through the work of Jesus and the apostles, and is something that is also demonstrated throughout today.
Yeah.
And that we have the authority to declare healing.
I think even if you disagree with the idea that it's always God's will to heal, I think if you're being honest with the Scripture, you can see where someone might get that.
Yeah.
Even if you disagree with it.
And I also think that those that lean more towards that charismatic theology do see more healings.
Well, now, Josh. Well, now. I'm not sure what I think about that. I'm just kidding.
But that still leads to the question of, you know, what about the myth ratio? And so there are a lot of ideas even within charismatic theology around that. There's one big one is the idea of needing faith to be healed.
Yeah.
And that can be abused. And I know many people who do believe in these lines of theology that readily admit that kind of thing is abused.
I'll be honest with you, and this is coming from someone who's theologically outside that camp, but I would need to hear a really good defense of why that's an acceptable theology, because it just seems like an open invitation to spiritual abuse to me. So, but I'm open to being rebuked on that. Just from my perspective, that seems like...
Well, I'll just give you one passage that says that Jesus did not do many miracles in a town because of their lack of faith.
Yeah.
And there are other references to saying, you know, talking about he was amazed at the faith he saw in a certain person.
Yeah.
And I think maybe James talks about, you know, let not, if you have doubt, let not him ask and expect to receive anything.
Yeah.
There
but
are,
you could also put that like directly next to the guy who's like, oh, Jesus, if you can heal my son, do it. And Jesus is like, did you say if? And he's like, oh, help my unbelief. And then Jesus heals his son.
Yeah.
You put it right next like, to that.
Mercy in spite of our lack of faith. And that's yeah. that's something that, I think most charismatics would readily agree with, that it's not a one all be all, but it can be a factor,
okay.
an important yeah. factor. And yeah, it can be easily abused as a, oh, if the, where the abuse comes in is if you don't experience healing. And then because of that, you think, oh, I must not have enough faith. And then you start to question your own faith.
Or if you're just flat out told,
yeah,
this would have changed. This would have gone
absolutely.
Down differently if you were more faithful.
Absolutely. But I think there is room for holding a nuance of this could, there's some evidence that that can be a factor.
Yeah, I'll take involved. That. I'll take that.
And there's other things. We don't have time to get into everything. I've heard about, there's this idea that sometimes if there's a lack of forgiveness in your heart or bitterness towards someone, that can sort of block a healing. There's other ideas
yeah,
about.
I've heard that before. Does that come from scripture?
I'm not totally sure on like the details of that.
Yeah,
I feel like it's a. I almost feel like it's something that like people that, are really into these things and have been involved in lots of healings. Like it's just a pattern that they believe they've noticed.
Gotcha.
And so, and they're. I think there are some scriptures you could point to in support of it, whether or not you would get it originally from those scriptures necessarily.
Yeah.
And there's other ideas about like curses that have to be broken, generational things, and lots of different ideas about like, you know, why a healing might happen or might not happen.
Yeah.
That can, you know, possibly explain certain things.
I gotta be honest though, dude, and again, this is like the outsider's eyes. Some of that stuff I think to the person outside the camp, you know what I mean, who hasn't
yeah.
grown up around that just sounds insane. Like when you start talking about like generational curses and those things, and I'm not even saying those, that's not a biblical principle and that doesn't reflect spiritual reality, but as someone who didn't grow up around that theologically, I can really sympathize with the person who looks at this discussion and just says, you're all crazy.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I totally understand that. And I understand someone that says, hey, this, you know, this worked in this circumstance or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah,
and
like,
that gives them a confidence that that is a real thing, you know, even if it doesn't work in every situation or whatever. Now for people who are not really into some of the charismatic line, for Christians trying to deal with a lack of healing, I think sometimes just kind of ascribe it to God's mysterious ways, or, you know, it just wasn't God's will. We don't understand. We just have to, you know, be okay with that.
Yeah. I think that's the big one is just going, well, this just wasn't God's will in this scenario, because you even see that language used on the other side. When I hear charismatic theologians and pastors speaking against that more moderate theology, that's the phrasing they use where they say, mm-hmm. it's always God's will.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Why would you like try to like stop people from, from receiving this thing?
Yeah.
I want to put on my scientific hat for a little bit and talk about some natural reasons that I think are good to consider.
Yeah.
Because we live in a natural world, that God designed one way or another.
God designed through a process called,
please see episode 3,
fill in the blank.
but you know, God designed us with...
For more information on the process by which the earth is created, please reference Jack Chick's track on Don't Make a Monkey Out of Me.
Like, we have immune systems that you get a cold and your body learns how to, like, remember the virus that caused that cold and respond to it the next time it sees it. Like,
yeah,
that's really cool. And so if you like got that cold and were expecting to like declare it away or even just pray that God would take it away, like, then would that deprive your body of the chance to learn how to fight it, like doing what it was intended to do?
Yeah. Or you could say God is taking the cold away by creating the physical system.
Yeah, totally.
Adapts and
beats
it.
This was pointed out to me once by my friend Tim Bowler, who, by the way, Tim, shout out. Thanks for like being such a big supporter of the podcast.
Thanks, Tim.
This was while we were both going to a more charismatic church. He pointed out in the verse that where Paul tells Timothy to drink a little wine for your frequent stomach ailments.
As a Reformed pastor, I love that verse.
That he didn't say, you know, you need to declare the sickness away from your body. It has no authority to be there. He was just like, hey, dude, drink some wine. And like, I wonder, and I could be totally off base theologically or scientifically, but I've read stuff about that we're learning about the microbiome and like,
yeah,
like the complex like system of bacteria that lives in your body.
Yeah, that stuff.
And literally has like multiple times more cells than your own cells, like all over your body. And like how fermented drinks like can strengthen the diversity of your microbiome and stuff.
Dude, that's why.
That's why Paul was like, drink some wine, dude.
Yeah, that's why it's good.
So, like, I think there can be a tendency to focus so much on God supernaturally intervening to heal that we can lose sight of the natural processes that God intended to work.
And so I think this is one of the biggest critiques, probably even I would say like a straw man critique of a more healing theology. You got the link that I sent you about the whole Victims of Religion website, right?
I don't think you sent it, but we talked about it.
So there's this thing, called Victims of Religion. I think it's like .org or something like that. It's really dark and kind of twisted, but it makes almost these like trading card, like with stats sort of things of different people connected to Christian churches and Christian families who've died of treatable or preventable illnesses because their church or family was seeking faith healing rather than medical treatment. And they catalog them, right? As kind of like a library, Victims of Religion sort of thing. And so this whole idea of going so far to the extreme to not even acknowledge the natural world and how it works and the tools available to us in the natural world is one. I think it's one of the biggest critiques against someone who's going to stand more theologically in the healing, in the realm of like healing and those things.
Yeah. And most people that I'm familiar with from charismatic world readily agree with the use of doctors and medical technology. I think it's kind of a straw man to try to, you know, I mean, there definitely are those extreme people out there.
But it's that, such an extreme, it's silly to define the whole group of people by it.
Yeah. And I mean, there are, you know, saying that that it's okay to have a cold because your body can learn how to fight it naturally. That does kind of, it doesn't really solve the problem of why would God be okay with you having a natural disease that's more serious that ends up killing you.
Yeah.
And I mean that can be a little more difficult. There's when you get into more serious stuff, I've heard like, you know, skeptics saying, why doesn't God ever heal amputees? Like implying that, oh, you know, all these light stories of healing maybe are coincidences or mental imagination or whatever.
This goes back to our last discussion of Darren Brown, right? You'll see the faith healer, you know, heal someone's vague lower back pain, but not grow back their arm.
Yeah, if God doesn't grow back people's... If you can do anything in my name and or ask anything and it will be done, then why doesn't that work for amputees having their legs grow back?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of charismatics would just respond and say, well, you know, even I don't have, I'll admit I don't have enough faith to pray for that. Or, you know, there may be other reasons that God wouldn't want to do that or see that as a sickness. I don't know.
I want you to push back on this, but that phrase seems like such a cop-out just to be like, I don't have enough faith to do that. I mean, in all the charismatic church, there's not a single person who holds to that who has enough, like, bold enough to just be like, let's make this happen. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like that would be almost like a, it's such a public, visible sign of God's supernatural working that it seems like it would almost be like a goalpost they're aiming for.
Maybe the other person doesn't also have that confidence.
Okay.
I don't know. But I think that there's an error of like let's suppose that for some unknown reason, even within charismatic theology, like God just chooses not to heal amputees. Like to the skeptic, that's an obvious proof that God just doesn't do healings because that's an obvious thing that he could do, but he doesn't. But I think that's also kind of making this error of like, it's not 100%, so it must be 0%. Like there could still be other healings that are real. And just even if like, you don't have an explanation that you like for why amputees don't have their legs grow back too, that in itself is not necessarily proof against the other cases.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wonder too, like, even within the construct of kind of the theology of having authority over sickness, like, if there might be limits to that, like, some people want to just, on both sides, take the idea of if you ask anything in my name, it will be done, with charismatics saying, see, that proves we should go for anything, and skeptics saying, see, that proves it's not real because anything doesn't happen. But then, like, you see, like, James says, you have, like, first he says, you have not because you ask not, and then right after that he says, you ask and you do not have because you ask for your own selfish pleasure. Like, he's producing a reason that you might ask for something and not receive it.
Yeah.
Like, even if Jesus says, ask for anything, he's providing, when you take the whole, you know, the whole scripture together, he's saying, well, but that doesn't mean you can just ask for something selfishly. Now, I'm not saying that healing is asking for selfishly, but that at least, like, opens the door to the idea that there could be other reasons and other factors that you can't just look at the one passage and assume that anything means literally anything.
Yeah.
Obviously, if two people ask for contradictory things, they both can't happen. And that doesn't, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't understand logic. So I think there's at least some room for some kind of humility there. And there's also this idea, even the idea that like we're redeemed from the curse of the law through Jesus's death on the cross and resurrection, we still die physically at some point. And I think sometimes there's, whether it's with kind of traditional evangelicals, just praying and praying and praying and praying for someone to be healed, or charismatics, like going all intense, doing different things to try to figure out like, what needs to be done to release this healing.
Yeah.
I heard this quote on Twitter once, and it's kind of stuck with me ever since, that a lot of Christians are more concerned with keeping saints out of heaven than keeping sinners out of hell.
Yeah.
Just like, that's like, I think sometimes we can forget that like, this is a, we believe this is a temporary world.
Yeah.
And this, like, as wonderful as it is and all the purposes for our lives and everything, like, we can kind of almost idolize, like, our own lives on this planet.
Yeah.
And not that doesn't make the grieving any, like, easier necessarily to deal with, but I don't know, it's something.
So we talked about this off air a little bit. I had an experience at a church I worked at where a guy had terminal cancer, and it was really, really bad, and he was kind of like just not, like, there wasn't a lot of time left. Like, his family got called out of, like, work and school and stuff to come spend time with them. It was like a, hey, you need to, you know, like, kind of say your goodbyes and those things. And our church rallied around this guy when this happened. And there was this all-night prayer vigil for him and his family and for healing and those things. And the next day, it was insane. There was like this, like this thing where the doctors were like, whoa, like things are not as bad as like we thought they were. Like, we actually think you can go home. Like, we think our treatment plan is working. And like, it seems like you're starting in remission and those things. And it was this insane turnaround, like from you need to say goodbye to actually you can go home and like do normal treatments. And it was this just such an empowering and exciting thing for our whole church body of like, we came around this, like we prayed and God showed up and it was powerful. And within a couple days of that, maybe a week, the guy drops dead and it hadn't gotten better. And it was just a misread. Mm-hmm. They thought things were taking a turn and they just weren't. And man, it was crushing.
Yeah.
I mean, just crushing in the moment, crushing for the family, crushing for the church. I mean, just tragically terrible. And honestly, it was that much worse because of the perceived victory, right? Yeah. Because of the perceived, like, oh, God showed up and this was so great. And that, I mean, that messed with several people in our churches. I mean, even like just their faith, like not even their theology of what does healing mean, but just their understanding of the gospel, their understanding of who God was. It was a trying time,
yeah,
for our church. And yet, on the other side of it, the process of going through mourning and the process of our church coming together in the midst of this dark time and this suffering, I would say, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that everyone involved walked on the other side of that tragedy with a clear understanding of who God was, with a richer faith. I mean, like, there was so much fruit born and so much growth and so much victory, I would say, that happened through that loss, but was farther down the road. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that might seem obvious to say that, but I feel like that's the piece of the puzzle that's missing when you hold on to a theology that says it's always God's will to heal. Because I and you can push back on this, I don't see that. I don't think that's scriptural. I don't think that's a correct, I just don't think it's a correct interpretation of scripture. And I would love for you or for listeners to push back on that with me. But It seems to me, both from my reading of scripture and from personal experience, that there is something beautiful and gospel and life-giving that happens in the midst of death and suffering.
Yeah. I'm not completely qualified to push back on that, other than to say that I know there is a theology around the idea that Jesus' death and resurrection included, like, victory over sickness and illness, in that it's a, you know, it's part of the curse of the fall, that it's something that we have victory over.
Yeah.
I do also, I love what you're saying about the growth that can come through through going through suffering together.
Yeah.
And I think the whole idea of suffering can be underappreciated.
Yeah.
Especially if you're focusing on the good things, the good parts of scripture and the victories. There's a whole passages about Peter and Paul and all over about suffering, not just as like in spite of, you know, what Jesus has done for us, but even like specifically pointing to like Jesus is suffering as a model for our own suffering.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's going back to James, like consider it pure joy when you face trials of various kinds.
And you could have a debate about whether or not sickness is supposed to be included in that suffering or not.
Yeah.
But
I don't think Job could have had a debate about whether or not sickness was included in that suffering, but
something I think about, and this goes kind of back to my analytical side, like when you hear someone, especially like in the modern age, 2017, someone young saying dying of cancer, something tragic like that, it's in this context of like this modern age where we all expect that people should be able to live to be 50, 60, 70, 80. Like, I think back to like the 1800s when
all your favorite authors lived.
When like, you know, you read some of these statistics, it's almost mind blowing. Like a fifth of children or whatever didn't even make it to age 4 or whatever.
Yeah.
Like so many common diseases and everything. And it's like what kind of theology did they have about this stuff? Like, I almost want, like, you would think that, like, as the natural world, as we make progress and technological discoveries and so many diseases have been eradicated, life expectancy going up, like, you think that would make us happier, make it easier to deal with. As the total, like, amount of suffering decreases, it would make it easier to deal with what was left. I almost wonder if it, like, makes it harder that it's, like, why is that bit still here? Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I would say a shallow theology of suffering is a privilege of the privileged.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like if you're going to be a believer in a world like the 1800s or like the first century, whatever, just not in our context, you have to have a theology of suffering. It's why whole books and whole sections of scripture are devoted to suffering and suffering being a tool of God's glory. Because if you didn't, I mean, people ask that, if you couldn't wrap your head and soul around that, then the Christian like life, the gospel life would just be worthless. It wouldn't mean anything.
Yeah. Well, and I also think about that too, like when one common, atheist argument is, you know, why is there so much suffering in the world? And that kind of goes beyond this topic into more general issue of theodicy.
Yeah, but, which we probably should talk about at some point.
Yeah. I just think it's just fascinating to me, like, historically perspective, like, this era of history probably has the least suffering in a lot of ways, you know.
And it probably, like, and we whine a ton about it.
The level of absolute poverty has fallen so much, like it's like almost like we don't even like fathom like how like the rest of the world has been rising out of poverty. Like,
yeah, well, even we don't, there are all sorts of, going to more specifically to our topic, there are all sorts of diseases and illnesses that aren't even a concern to us anymore.
Yeah. And so not that the amount of suffering currently is like not a problem or something that needs to be like discussed and wrestled with.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting that, like,
the overall experience of human suffering seems to have gone down.
And it's like, what, you know, what, and yet there was, like, you know, so many, like, what did Christians of the past, like, deal with when it was even so much worse? Like,
yeah.
And I think that goes to back what you're talking about. Maybe we're just, like, less familiar with that, like, kind of theology these days.
Yeah.
Both sides.
My faith tradition would wrestle with this idea and would essentially tell you, and I say my faith tradition, this is where I land on this, but But this is where I think most of the theologians and thinkers of my tradition, a more Baptistic Reformed tradition, would land, is this idea that God owns joy and God owns suffering, and that God is glorified in both. That godly suffering and godly death brings God. Those are my dogs.
Hello.
But godly suffering and godly death brings God just as much, if not more, glory than godly joy and godly healing and those sorts of things. That the way we experience illness and loss and pain and eventually death brings God just as much glory and advances the kingdom just as much as the way we experience blessing and health and life.
I think this is something that, you know, non-charismatics and charismatics can learn from each other, maybe.
Yeah.
I think non-charismatics, I think I would encourage them to be more open to supernatural and healing.
Yeah.
And not just afraid of, you know, getting your hopes up, but, you know, consider, you know, maybe try some of these, like, declaring healing over something that's not going away, or looking into some of these things, like, you know, what have you got to lose? Like, even if the charismatic theology isn't 100% or 99%, like, even if you just go from 10% to 30%, like,
did you just Pascal's wager me on faith healing? Is that what you're doing right now?
Yeah, I think I am.
Get out of here, Josh.
Yeah. You know, it.
No, I'm with you. I get what you're saying.
It, you know, there could be, maybe there's something there that's true and awesome. And at the same time, I think charismatics, I would encourage to be more open to the idea of a theology of suffering. You know, regardless of how you think about it or integrate it, to look at those passages and think about them, and, you know, so you don't have this, to consider those, the consequences that can come from the abuse.
So here's my question for you, Josh. I love this idea of kind of challenging the more charismatically leaned and leaning and non-leaning, like challenging them with bits of each other's theology. I love that idea. So I think that's a wonderful place to land a discussion like this theologically. But where do you land? What do you say to the skeptic listening to this who just says, this is all junk. It's just the normal statistical variance of people getting better.
Just coming up with ways to deal with what is obviously the natural world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What do you think how would you conclude this discussion with that person?
I feel like
in this, because this is an area where we have strikingly dissimilar theological bents, we've more been kind of engaging each other's bent,
mm-hmm.
and less engaging, yeah. probably just the outside voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a sense in which this discussion around this goalpost, so to speak, is kind of assuming that you do believe healing is possible.
Yeah.
And it's answering the question of, if it is, then how do you deal with lack of healing?
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't believe healing's possible, then it's...
Then why are you still listening? I mean, thank you, but...
That's where kind of the previous episode, we were arguing why we did believe that.
Yeah.
And so on this, I think to the skeptic, I would just say, yeah, I acknowledge that you would think this is a ridiculous discussion. But hopefully we've explained our reasons why we think it's not ridiculous.
Well, you know, the one thing I would say, I think, to a skeptic in this discussion, it's like that. I mean, I would affirm that, yeah, like if you're someone where... you don't have a faith. You're not engaging this from a supernatural theological perspective. I would want to start by saying I totally understand how crazy it sounds for us to even talk about these things. But I also think there can be a good challenge for just I think the theology of healing can really build an undergirding of hope and of optimism when it comes to physical limitations and sickness and illness. Whereas I see often that a more naturalistic worldview can build a lot of pessimism and negativity when it comes to physical limitations and suffering and illness. And so I would say that could potentially be a good challenge for someone who's a more skeptic listening to this sort of discussion. Just say, hey, there's an attitude that is positive and optimistic about the limitations that come with physicality. And I think that's something that can be learned from and gleaned from, even as a skeptic.
Yeah, that was really nice. Good stuff.
That was nice.
You're good with the words sometimes, Sam.
Do we have anything else to say about this?
I think we actually did a pretty good job of not rambling too much, I hope.
Yeah, I feel good about this. I feel like we've put a good bow on this discussion. Unless someone wants to email us something and tell us just a huge thing we missed.
But nobody did about the last one, so
yeah,
I guess we must not have been too bad.
Or it was just that bad. Like, I don't even know what to say to this.
I did make it through.
So what's our transition sound effect?
I don't know. Pick.
Not that one?
No. What else you got? You just need to, like, come up with one. Meme of the week. I like it.
Okay. So this is probably getting a little political for us, but I think that's okay. I think especially I think the atmosphere.
So we need to just do a whole episode about refugees, and yes. Yeah, that whole issue that has been, I don't know what time it is when you're listening to this, but that has been a major issue in the United States political and theological discussions.
And it was already right on our now, list of things to talk about too,
because of the practical effects of the new administration's policy changes.
Yeah.
So we definitely want to talk about that. I also want to talk about annihilationism.
Yeah, me too.
Because I know we have some listeners that are interested in learning more about that.
I also want to, someone specifically requested that we talk about the validity of apologetics.
Oh, yes.
And I really want to talk about that because I've got some strong opinions on that I think will be good.
So give us a vote. Refugees, annihilationism, or the validity of apologetics?
No, don't give us a vote, because that'll make me feel really bad for how few people vote.
I'm Sam, where's your sense of hope and optimism? I'm trying to increase user participation.
Yeah. Sorry. So for our kind of thought of the week this week, we're looking at a tweet from a guy named Gideon Glick. I don't know who that is. I think this will be good, but at the same time, now that we're talking about it, I'm kind of really over some parts of this, but we'll talk about it anyway. So Gideon tweeted, he said, here's a 1941 Dr. Seuss cartoon criticizing America's stance on denying Jews safe haven. Recognize the t-shirt slogan. And in the cartoon, it's a political cartoon drawn by Dr. Seuss, which is weird. A lot of people don't know he was a political cartoonist before he went into children's books. But it's a grandma sitting in like an overstuffed chair with two kids sitting on the arms of the chair, and she's reading a book to them. And the book is called Adolf the Wolf. And the grandma's saying, and the wolf chewed up the children and spit out their bones. But those were foreign children, so it didn't really matter. And her shirt says America First on it. And so the point there being that it's, you know, here's this American social issue from how we dealt with the Nazis, and, you know, obviously drawing parallels to now how we're engaging ISIS and terrorism in the Middle East, and the whole America First slogan is like a common phrase like between the two. So I think there's some good stuff to talk about there. But before you comment on it, Josh, I have to say, like, I'm not a big pro-Trump guy, but I actually am really over how many people are trying to, like, compare him to Hitler and, like, comparing his leadership to, like, just fascist Germany. So, like, it just seems extreme to me and kind of stupid. Yeah. But anyway, I want to hear your thoughts on the cartoon.
It's complicated.
Should I take from that you're not over those comparisons?
This is the kind of thing that I want to speak carefully about.
I feel like I don't want to speak carefully about it. I feel like most people make those comparisons. They're comparing Trump to like fascist Germany, not because they actually have thoughtful like connections to like the similarities between policy, but just because they hate Trump and they're like, let me call Trump Hitler. That makes me feel good.
I mean, that's kind of been the U.S. tradition for the last few presidential cycles is to call the other guy Hitler.
Exactly. That's why it frustrates me. So if someone actually had like valid, thoughtful discussion of like, oh, these are things we should really be cautious of and we've seen these before, I would totally be open to that. I just haven't experienced that.
I think I have actually read a couple articles making that argument. I'll try to find that and send it to you. And maybe we can talk about it more if we do a refugee episode. I think what I will say is just to provide some historical context to that cartoon, which I am no expert on these by any means, but what I have heard and what I am open to either learning more about or being corrected on. What I've heard is that in the late 30s, I guess, 1930s, Germany was trying to expel all of the Jews in Germany before going to what they ominously called the final solution. One of the early things was just trying to get them all out of their country.
Yeah.
And part of that was like trying to find countries that would accept them.
Yeah.
And what I have heard then is that, well, what I know pretty strongly documented is that the United States refused at least one specific ship that was full of Jewish immigrants. And what I have heard is that part of it had to do with fear that they were Nazi sympathizers.
Gotcha.
Which today sounds totally ridiculous to us.
Yeah.
But, like, not being fully aware of the historical context, like, who knows, like, what people were hearing and seeing and thinking that to them maybe they thought that was a reasonable concern. And I know that also, in general, there's historically a trend of anytime there was a new group of immigrants or refugees coming in somewhat large numbers to America, there were fears they were communist sympathizers or, you know, this, that, or the other.
Whoever the new guy is terrible, basically.
Well, the new group of a new ethnic group that you're not familiar with. And so it is very natural to make comparisons to the current crisis. Now you can also make an argument that, you know, there's something specific about radical Islamic terrorism that you need to be concerned about. And that's something we can discuss more fully if we do a whole episode on this. But I think it's good to be aware of our natural historical tendency to be afraid and to, you know, make decisions that we look back now and regret.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I like it. Your response was really thoughtful to Midas being like, damn, I don't like this, man. So thanks for that.
It was a lot more thoughtful than some of what I've tweeted over the last couple of days.
Yeah. Yeah. You and a lot of other people, Josh. Well, I guess that's it. We're good?
Yeah.
Anything else on your heart and soul and mind?
That is pretty much a big one right now. So.
Okay, cool. Well, as we're wrapping up, as always, we want to say a big thank you to Kingly. That's their track, Running. It's a single. They allow us to use it on our podcast. Guys, thank you so much for letting us use your amazing music on our crappy podcast. Please go check out Kingly online. They have an EP out on all digital ways of buying music. It is available. Go support them. They are a great worship band making excellent music here in St. Louis. So a shout out to them. Yeah, man. I guess we're good.
All right. Well, I guess I'm going to go listen to a hip Christian worship band because I'm a good Christian.
I'm going to go read a John Piper book because I'm a heretic. Bye.
Bye.